In a recent article in The Atlantic, Derek Thompson argues that, quote, American meritocracy is killing youth sports, unquote. Participation in youth sports has been declining and is now at about only 37%. But the story, Thompson writes, is not universal. While poor kids are participating at their lowest rates ever, merely 34%, in homes earning over $100,000, 69% of kids play team sports. Thompson argues that the problem is a byproduct of contemporary U.S. inequality. High-income parents are buying their kids' way onto elite travel teams, leaving community leagues low in participation and funding, and sending a message to those community teams that they're second class, their participants' dreams of glory, doomed to come to nothing. This divergence is just one more instance of opportunity hoarding by rich and upper-middle-class parents, who not only spend more on their children, but spend a greater percentage of their income on their children than do poorer families. Thompson suggests that spending on children is a luxury consumption good. Thompson argues that this trend is bad for children and bad for the country, not only for youth sports, but for all sports, and it seems to be getting worse rather than better. What do we do about this? And what's the alternative to the elite club team that's become the vehicle of rich families' opportunity hoarding? Well, to think more about this, I'm sitting down with Patrick Fitzgerald, who last year took over as director of Highland Youth Recreation, HYR, a community sports organization running soccer, baseball, and now basketball programs. I also want to send a shout-out to Leslie Gross, the longtime director of HYR and the architect and chief steward for decades of HYR's community-building vision. It's Ethics Forward on WFMP 106.5 FM in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. My name is Avery Kohlers. I teach philosophy at U of L, and every week I sit down with a scholar, an activist, or a practitioner to take you on a deep dive into ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. Today we're thinking about youth sports and their role in childhood and in society. My guest is Patrick Fitzgerald. We'll be back in a moment. Fitzgerald, welcome to Ethics Forward.
Great, thanks for having me.
Well, you're the director of Highlands Youth Recreation, a project of Highlands Community Ministries, and full disclosure, my own kids play HYR and have been doing so for years, though I should also admit that one of my kids has played on a club team in the past. And what I love most about HYR is the ethos, so I wonder if you could start us off by talking a bit about that. What makes HYR tick? What makes it special?
Well, I have kind of a unique perspective on that in that I played in the very first HYR soccer team in 1976.
Wow.
And the genius of HYR is that in a world that was surrounded by all school-oriented teams, a bunch of parents in the Highlands got together and got an agreement with Atherton High School and Highland Middle School, which were green spaces that were just tailor-made for this type of activity, and convinced them to allow Highlands Youth Recreation to run a sports league on their fields, on their practice fields. And also that it was created with the intent that parents would coach their own children, so all the coaches would be volunteers. So that was started up in 1976, and I played HYR baseball, soccer, and basketball in the 1970s, played it for about 4 or 5 years. And then years later, when I had my own kids, I started coaching when my daughter Riley turned 5 years old. And I've coached Highland Youth Recreation teams for 16 or 17 years, and I've probably coached a total of 40 seasons. So it's been a big part of my life up until now. When the previous director, Leslie Gross, was going to retire 2 years ago, I thought about it for a few days and then decided it would be a perfect thing for me to apply. I was winding up a career in public service in engineering, and it was fitting my lifestyle of getting outside more and doing more community-based things, and so it just was a perfect fit.
Right.
To your original question of what makes HYR special, people have used the word non-competitive before, and I'm not a big fan of that word because I hope that at any given moment everybody's trying to get that ball and pass and score and all the things that you do in a game of soccer or baseball. But I suppose that rather than say non-competitive, I think that a better way of describing it is an educational league or as a developmental league. And by that we mean that some of the players who eventually will outgrow HYR to go and play for their middle school or high school or a club level team will develop those skills at a time that they're building relationships, friendships with other children their same age. A lot of players will continue to play HYR because they like the atmosphere of HYR, or might not make their middle school team, might not make their high school team, but they still like that community atmosphere of HYR, playing with their peers, with the coaches being non-professional coaches, being the parents of friends of theirs, and kids they've played with since they were 5 years old.
So how does the developmental, educational, rather than non-competitive, how does it play out? And I don't know if you want to draw a contrast with, say, a club team or a school team, but how does that change the experience of the kids on a daily level, on a daily basis?
I think for the kids on a game-by-game basis, it's the fact of equal playing time. Mm-hmm. And so there is not an attempt to have your best players in at all times. It's equal playing time for all the players. Because it is a more relaxed atmosphere on the field for the parents, I don't think that there's the pressure to feel like they have to make every game. There's a lot of kids who make every game, but you know, parents go away for spring break and they just go. They go away for fall break and they just go. And occasionally we will play with less players, but for the most part, it's a relaxed atmosphere where the focus is not on the competitive nature of it. It's competitive in that everybody's trying to score, but the parents are often in a lawn chair, just in a sort of relaxed sort of atmosphere. They're having conversations, and sometimes your child scores, and somebody says, "Hey, your kid just scored a goal." And so it's not the entire experience. I would say the other thing, we don't officially keep score. Part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, having scoreboards for so many games going on at Atherton would be kind of difficult. You could easily have a small board with vinyl letters and flip the score, but we've just never put the emphasis on the score. Leslie Gross used to say, if you post the score, then coaches will coach to the score and players will play to the score.
Right.
So if it were a soccer World Cup game and your team were up 2-0, you wouldn't do anything aggressive. You would go back and play conservative ball.
Right.
Or in a basketball world, it's kind of like the Dean Smith four-corner offense that I grew up watching on. You know, if they got ahead, they would just hog the ball and there was no shot clock.
Right.
So I think that that's true, very much what Leslie said, is that at any given moment, you should be playing soccer like, I'm going to pass and I'm going to score, and this is a scoring opportunity, and not based on, well, it's late in the game, we better just be really conservative about the way we play.
Right.
So I guess that's one way the lack of keeping score comes into effect in the game.
Right. My experience has been that, I mean, sometimes the teams are sort of not quite balanced, but if the teams are relatively well balanced and they've both scored a number of goals or a number of runs in baseball, everybody believes that their own team is ahead. They're all wrong about the score. So everybody can believe they've won if there's no canonical score.
I don't know. I tend to think that people keep score in life quite a bit. I think they generally know. You might be right, though. There may be some disputed scores in there.
Yeah. That reminds me of one question. With a club team, a coach is going to be trying to develop a team that is sort of as good as possible. There will be people cut. They might go out and try to recruit players from other clubs or whatever. HYR doesn't involve that, but there is this issue that sometimes there are just teams, and my kids have been on teams that were on the upside of this and on the downside of this, that just seem to dominate and win, score a lot more goals than other teams. Do you think that's a bug that needs to be addressed or inevitable? Or
I think, first off, anybody who's played more than a couple seasons of sports, and probably in a number of leagues, has been on both sides of that, where
right.
we've had a year when my son was young where we scored several times a game and other seasons where we didn't score the entire season. So I think that's part of the nature of sports. But I think in our league there is a mood at the moment, and I took a survey about this at the end of the season, that there is a mood to start to work towards balance of teams.
Right.
And the nuance of that is going to be, at what age do you start that? But it would probably involve some sort of rating system for the players by either coaches or parents. And then during the team building process, then we would build in something that we would try and ensure that not all the strong players are on one team, and the opposite also true. The difficulty in doing that for us is that because we have so many siblings playing in the league and so many people who've played together with their friends for so long, some of the strength of a team can happen because you have two kids who are particularly good and they start playing together every season, and then another kid joins in with them. And so you end up with a lot of players who are particularly good, who like their coach, and so you end up getting a consistency that can sometimes lead to that inequality where one team gets a bunch of kids who've never played together before and are maybe not the strongest players. And so we're looking at how to address that. We've got a committee of coaches who are going to kind of try and address that. Thankfully, when we do team building, aside from all the people who can only practice on Tuesday night with Coach Patrick or whatever, there are also a lot of people who check the box says, I can practice any night.
Right.
And so the flexibility that will give us, as well as potentially breaking up some of the groups if we find out that a team is just too much of a juggernaut or something like that.
Right.
That's a goal we have in the league, and we haven't started it yet, but probably in future seasons you'll see that.
Yeah. And my understanding is that the idea of equal playing time, of not keeping score, is also part of a conception of what the point of youth sports is and how you want kids to come out of this. Is it fair? Does HYR have that sort of commitment to the ethical development of children, I guess, in the background, or is that just sort of...
Well, I grew up going to private school, but it was a Catholic school, and so it wasn't a private school where it was a neighborhood school. So it wasn't necessarily a school where only people could afford to go went. I think the world is divided up into places where everybody is a participant, and public schools is one example of that, and most places of employment are that way. You know, and unless you are at a very top level of your field, banking or medical or something like that, maybe engineering as well. But if you're at the very top of your field, then maybe it's extremely selective and you are only with the top talent. But for the most of us, and especially for the youth who are going to be, their first jobs are going to be entry-level jobs.
Right.
And so many of their schools are going to be public schools, and so many of their peer groups are going to be people who just happen to live in their neighborhood. You don't get to pick who you work with, and you don't get to pick who you go to school with, and you don't get to pick your neighbors.
Right.
And granted, some, you know, you may feel in life that there's some neighborhoods that are more exclusive than others and all that sort of thing, but life is about making community from the people who are around you. And the Select League can often be a metaphor for selective versions of where people live, or selective versions of where people go to school or where they're employed. And I think HYR is an attempt to model real life. If you had the analogy of a chain is, you know, as strong as its weakest link, if you have to play everybody, then sooner or later, your goal as a team is to get that weakest link to be stronger, because then your team is stronger.
Right.
And in a select league, that weakest link may not ever get off the bench.
Right.
And so that's, you know, that's a metaphor for life that I think HYR does fairly well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So I started with the discussion of that Derek Thompson article in The Atlantic about American meritocracy killing youth sports. Would you say that's true, or would you say, well, there's a whole sports ecosystem and HYR has a place and club teams have a place and, you know, let a thousand flowers bloom?
Well, the first thing about the HYR experience that I think perhaps is different from, maybe I'll start with the article itself. I think the article itself pointed out, as you mentioned in the introduction, that the distinguishing part was that youth sports overall has dropped a certain amount. Some of that might be injury related with football and concussions and that sort of thing, but part of it could be with baseball, because baseball has lost in popularity. So soccer is an up-and-coming sport. Soccer and baseball are the two sports that I'm aware of that are quite on the rise, at least in this part of the... Soccer and basketball are the ones that are kind of on the rise in this part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But within that, they talked about the two tracks where, even though the overall number has dropped, that wealthier families were getting their kids into club teams and select teams and travel teams. And so the percentages they used were that wealthier kids were now playing youth sports at a higher rate by 4 or 5%, and the less wealthy families were losing participation by 8 to 10%. So okay, overall there was a drop of maybe 3 or 4%, but it's because the inequity, the less financially wealthy families were dropping at a higher rate,
right,
than the other were growing. So the loss came from that side of the social equation. So the way that HYR is different than that is in a few different ways. One, because we have volunteer coaches, we're one of the most affordable ways that you can play. Consistently, we are the least expensive one that I survey, and I do call around places every season. Right now, we're at $67 for a season. Similarly, the YMCA has leagues where they have volunteer coaches, and so they're not too, I think they're a little bit more expensive, and they probably have a little bit more overhead because they're part of a larger organization.
Right.
When you go to other leagues, which I won't mention by name, when they start having paid coaches, indoor facilities, and just a bigger machine that has to be churned with the number of employees and that sort of thing, it gets to where they're cost to participate in the league is, you know, 2, 3, or 4 times what it costs to play a season at HYR.
Right.
And then sometimes on top of that, there's a uniform fee because they have a fancier uniform. They have a matching top and bottom and socks and things
right,
like that. The other thing that is perhaps different about HYR is that about 15% of our league are on some type of scholarship. By scholarship, I mean financial assistance. And so that's a big part of it, that your $67 to pay for, it does pay for cutting the grass, it pays for lining the fields and a number of things, but a little bit of that goes to pay for some player who can't afford to pay.
Right.
And so it has a little bit of socialized thing about it that I don't think anybody in our league objects to. And when people register for our league, there's a spot where people can donate, and we collected over $1,000 in donations at the beginning of the season from people. When they registered the $67, they just said and tack an extra $10 or $25 onto it.
Right.
And that leads to the next sort of scholarship opportunity that we offer, is that we have a big participation from Kentucky Refugee Ministries and from the Backside Learning Center. They serve the families of people who work at Churchill Downs. And the people who work at Churchill Downs may be seasonal, but the families might live in Louisville year-round.
Right.
We've reached out also to Catholic Charities, who has a big immigrant population as well, and they're not on board yet, but they may join in with a similar way as Kentucky Refugee Ministries in future seasons. So the way it works right now, about 10% of the league is made up of players who are international players who have been in the country, many of them just in the past handful of years, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
They may have been in war-torn countries. The majority of the players we have in our league are from Central Africa or the Middle East. One of the distinguishing factors is their countries where soccer is the number one thing instead
right,
of the number 3 or 4 or 5 thing.
Right.
And so the level of play is often quite good from these players. And one of the equality things we've tried to do to make the teams even is to try and, whenever possible in the older divisions, try and divide them up fairly evenly, because they can, the skill level is often noteworthy to the point that if you put them all on one team, the KRM players might not ever have anybody score on them.
Right.
They're quite good.
Right. Can you say anything about whether the KRM connection and Backside Learning Center connection has generated community between the players from the different backgrounds, or is that still a work in progress?
Yeah, so the connection with Kentucky Refugee Ministries, it started back in the 6 months before I became the director, and it was right around the time that Leslie was saying she was going to retire, and we were having a discussion just about the number of players on scholarship, which at the time was not as high as it is today by any stretch, but it was also, we didn't get many requests as an organization. And so at this time, before we were reaching out to the international community, it was just somebody, for example, if somebody's on free and reduced lunch at school, they might think that maybe that would be something that, hey, we'll give you our free and reduced lunch paperwork, and can you give us a break on the soccer fees? And we would always grant that. And one of the steering committee members, Lori Wade, said, you know, we ought to reach out to Kentucky Refugee Ministries. And I didn't have a relationship with them yet. And this was in between seasons, so it was around November, you know, right after a soccer season ended. And I took over as director in January. And there were two things, one's frivolous and one's not frivolous, that I decided that I wanted to address. And one of them was I wanted to put some graphic design on the T-shirts because, you know, I wanted little logos of whatever team names like Aardvarks or Gila Monsters or whatever it would be. And the other one was a serious thing, which is to reach out in a diversity sort of way to make sure that we reached out at the suggestion that Lori had made to Kentucky Refugee Ministries. So I called them. And the first season, I think we had 23 players. And I reached out to Adrian Eisenmenger at Kentucky Refugee Ministries, and we started up a partnership. We didn't have any pieces in place, and the majority of those families don't have transportation. Or if they do have transportation, they may have one car, and the parents of those families tend to work the jobs that you and I don't, which means nights and weekends, and so they end up on the schedule where it'd be very difficult for them to drive a kid to soccer practice because they're working at that time. And they don't live in the Highlands for the most part because they live where the populations of international families end up just because of rental availability and affordability and that sort of thing. So they end up being 10 or 15 minutes south and west of Atherton High School where we play soccer as opposed to 2 minutes away by bike or car where a lot of the HYR families traditionally come from. So we got volunteers to drive them to as many games as possible. And we set up a sign-up genius for each player from Kentucky Refugee Ministries. We had people sign them up. They had sibling groups, too. So sometimes, you know, we would group them so they all practiced on the same night or things like that. And we did that for a season, and it was tough. It was really hard to get them all there. And if you were the volunteer for this one child and you were going on spring break, then that family didn't make it to the games either. And so we figured out that we could afford to do some little fundraising and get donations to get someone to drive those kids. And so we found this guy named Kareem. And Kareem is from Iraq, and he's been in the United States for 2 or 3 years, and he's got kids of his own, and they've played HYR as well. So we got Kareem on board to drive the kids. So there's a church van that's a 12-person van, and we schedule so that on practice days, we schedule some on Monday, some on Tuesday, some on Wednesday, and so on, so that he can drive around and pick up the kids and bring them to practices. So we pay for that. We pay for his time, and we pay for the gas and the maintenance on the vehicle. So that's an expense that we took on. And so between Kentucky Refugee Ministries and the league's fundraising and, you know, a variety of sources, that we are getting that paid for. So that's been a way we've been able to get them all to the games. And once they're on a team, I think the really great thing is to see a lot of those kids make friends. You know, even in their schools, sometimes they can be isolated or they can be in a group just with other international kids or just with other kids who are recent refugees because they don't have the social network. I remember the first season, there was a boy from Tanzania who at the end of the season got invited to a pizza party and sleepover and with all of these friends, and they all loved him. He was a good soccer player, but he just made friends with all these kids. And so that's kind of the ultimate goal of having those kids play soccer with us, is get them integrated with members of the community and just a support network of people. I've had a couple of the families over to my house, had them over for dinner, and it's an interesting, you know, cultural exchange and just to understand the difference between how we all live. And I remember a discussion with one of the uncle of the kids who played in the league, and we were talking about a car, and he was wanting to buy a car, and he said, well, a new car costs several thousand dollars, and you make this much money in a paycheck, so how would you ever buy a car? And the whole idea of how a mortgage worked or how a car payment worked, that where he had come from, and he had grown up in Congo, that payment plan wasn't a part of their understanding. And so you can imagine a lot of people, a lot of Americans grow up and they might learn that from their parents, or might learn it from their peers, or they have all this sort of built-in knowledge. And that knowledge, although Kentucky Refugee Ministries offers classes and offers information for all of its clients, there's a lot of things that take them a while to pick up on. And and so sometimes the people on their team or their new friends from HYR become part of that here's how you navigate this system we have in the modern United States and how you sort of navigate that. And I feel like it has really strengthened a lot of people's commitment to HYR who have been in the league for a long time. They see the addition of these kids. And when I think of a recent resettled family and they don't have many connections to people in Louisville, how great it is for a kid from Syria to get to come to the field and play and get out and run around. They might live in a neighborhood where there's not a lot of green space. They might live in a neighborhood where they don't get much outdoor time. And one of the things they miss about, even though they might have been in a refugee camp or they might have been in a war-torn country, they were outside all the time. Mm-hmm. And they come to the United States and they find out that all of their time is indoors because of some perception of safety or the way that Americans work with their kids or the fact there's not many outdoor spaces for them.
Right.
But the other great thing about that for an American child is to grow up playing with those kids at school or on the soccer field and to recognize that a Syrian is a person. You know, if you listen to the news, you know, Syria is just this place where this war happens, and it might sound scary, and the people might, you know, have, you might have impressions of them from listening to people in government or listening to, you know, people in the news, and you might just say, oh, that's Hassan, and he plays on my team, and he's a really good soccer player. And so it just sort of humanizes what your impression is of what an international person, where they came from and what their life was like. One of the most poignant conversations with the teen group about a year and a half ago was one of the families from Zambia, one of their oldest kids, one of the American kids asked him how he liked it here in the United States. And he said, oh, it's great. And he said, what do you like about it? And he said, well, access to things. He said, oh, like what? Like Wi-Fi or education? And he goes, no, food and water. And so it was pretty noteworthy that so many of the things, this is, you know, this isn't a surprise to anyone here, but, you know, we can get wrapped up in our first world problems and that non-first world problems are how much of the day is gathered around things that are essentially not difficult for Americans to come by.
Right.
So, that you know, I think that's eye-opening. And probably the younger kids don't pick up on that. And some of the older kids do pick up on that.
Yeah. That's amazing.
I'll be back with Patrick Fitzgerald in just a moment. But first, here's Carly Johnson with Hit the Ground Running from her EP Demons.
A woman's only good at her work. I said I leave long ago. Well, I'm still here and I'm still waiting and I'm still learning to say no. I've given him my step with step. I've given him my step at speed. I've given love the fancy that it loves me more than it may see. It's time to cut my out now.
I'm talking to Patrick Fitzgerald, who is the director of Highlands Youth Recreation, HYR, about a vision of youth sports and building community. And Patrick, you were talking about the initial connection with KRM, and I want to come back to that in a minute, but I really wanted to ask this question. One of the things that I enjoy about HYR, I think my kids do too, is that everybody gets a medal. And you hear this as a criticism of youth sports today. Everybody gets a medal. Everybody gets a trophy. The irony is, of course, if Derek Thompson's article is right, that meritocracy is killing youth sports, that the opposite problem is actually the real problem, that people are barred from being able to shine on their own terms. I don't want this to be too much of a softball. Do you hear that as a criticism? Everybody gets a medal? Or is it something that...
I just took a survey at the end of the year and asked the league 10 different questions, and one of them had to do with the awards that we give out.
Uh-huh.
And 5-year-olds love to get a little medal. And just for reference, we're talking about something that when you buy them in bulk end up costing a couple dollars. And it doesn't add a lot of price right. to the league. And I think that they all like that. You know, my kids have done a variety of activities from dance to musical things or academic competitions that get involved in some sort of medal. I don't have a super strong opinion about there being a trophy or not a trophy, because I honestly feel like the strongest thing that kids come away with is the experience, and then I think the team picture is something that's valuable, you know, to be able to look back at that, especially just as time passes for some families who don't get a lot of pictures, especially before we are all carrying a camera in our pocket. You know, sometimes you would look back and find out that was one of the few pictures you really had, good pictures you had from that year.
Right.
But the trophies, you know, I feel like it's, for some kids, it's an important, you know, for a 5-year-old, they really enjoy that, and as kids get older, then we stop giving out, you know, medals or trophies. And there's something about that, you know, if it's important to a small child, I think that's great. But again, I don't think it's the major takeaway from the experience.
Right. And so on this issue of sort of everybody gets a trophy, I think the criticism of that is that it builds self-esteem that has no foundation in reality. I don't particularly share this view, but I'm trying to articulate it, that we want kids to build self-esteem that's grounded in accomplishment and achievement rather than that has no foundation in reality.
So as far as building the self-esteem, I mean, I feel like that's the major takeaway from youth activities, period. I've been a scout leader. I've led music clubs. I've led media clubs, coached HYR teams for a long time. And the major takeaway from all that is really teaching kids self-confidence. And through sport or music or basket weaving or whatever the activity is, you know, seeing something that you want to do, seeing something you want to be able to do, seeing something you want to be, and finding a path to get there is really a hugely important thing. And as a society, we're putting kids in youth activities that are great for that ability to build self-confidence, but they're not necessarily on-the-job training, because mm-hmm. there are going to be, you know, the number of professional positions available for chess players and soccer players and ballerinas is very low. And
right.
so, you know, the main goal, I think, of that is the ability that someday they will be able to shake hands with somebody, look them in the eye, and say, I'd like a job, and I'd like to be able to work here, and I'd like to be able to earn your respect by my job performance. And maybe that starts with seeing that soccer ball and saying, I can do this. I can take mm-hmm. that ball from that other player. I can go and pass. I can score. And I can do this dance. I can play, you know, whatever your activity is, that's really all we're teaching. And, you know, the majority of the organizations that I've been involved with, I started some of them, so I had control over the sandbox. And some of the ones like Scouts, you know, I guess all I would say about the organizations, and this applies to sports quite a bit too, which is that I think that any organization that gets involved in mentoring is doing a good thing. Anything mm-hmm. that is trying to take a young person and help them become a better older person is really fantastic. And that's a great way that adults and children can interact together. The only time I would disagree with that is if the organization is too prescriptive about what being a better older person is.
Right.
And if that is in the case of, you know, putting them down a set of beliefs, political or religious, or if it's sending them down a way of being uber competitive, that's when an organization is maybe overstepping that. With our focus on community and our focus on building, you know, skills and building friendships and building skills in a way that is respectful of others, I feel like that's what we're trying to teach kids. And so that's the reward for doing this type of thing, is building self-confidence and building community.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Yeah, you reminded me of this, being in philosophy, we get a lot of, well, you know, why should the state or the university fund philosophy if people aren't going to go on to jobs as philosophers? And my response is always, well, geez, they don't ask that question about the football team or the basketball team.
Sure, sure.
Not very many of them are going to go on to be basketball players or football players. And yet, yeah, it's interesting this that you can be developing a lot of skills that will be very valuable for you in the future, but in a general way, not skills just because it's on-the-job training, right?
So, right, right, for sure.
So I wanted to get back to KRM. So your links to KRM go beyond HYR, right?
Sure. Two of the things that I became known for in working with children came to a head when I became the director of HYR, is that I started to take this video producing, video editing skill that I've developed and have worked with kids. I've run video clubs and camps with kids so they learn how to do it. So you have third, fourth, and fifth graders who know how to make an entire broadcast. You know, mm-hmm. they record, they're good on camera, they're good at editing. So, you know, that's something that we got used to doing in other clubs. And so I brought that to HYR. And so we started making videos. And so the kids would get on camera and get to test out their on-camera skills. And because of that, and several of the KRM players had been on, KRM asked me to be the videographer for another project they were doing. Uh-huh. So they were doing a project called We Create, and it was a project where they wanted to document immigrant stories, and they were going to pick, you know, 5 to 10 people and follow their standard set of questions, you know, 10 to 15 questions about what was life like where you were from, what type of conflict led you to want to leave that place, what was your journey like to get here to the United States, and how have you been received once you got here? Questions all based on those themes.
Right.
And so I became the videographer for that project. And so from a strict documentarian standpoint, there was a KRM person asking all the questions. And on those interview days, all I was doing was running the camera. But then I would take those back and then categorize what was in those interviews. And we, from each person's interview, which maybe would have 60 to 90 minutes worth of talking, depending on how much the person would speak, we would end up with an edited version that was less than 10 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And the really interesting thing about that was that they tended to focus not on the conflict. So when you ask them about when you left Syria, what was going on, the conflict would inevitably come up. Mm-hmm. Like, why did you want to leave Syria? But they tended to spin it so much more positive, and it was so much, it's very eye-opening for somebody who's, you know, somebody whose major conflict in a given day might be a delayed airplane flight or somebody being out of your particular flavor of soda wherever you're shopping for that day, you know,
right.
First world problems.
Right.
And to see people who had real problems focus on, and then we got here and we had these really great people who helped us. Or we've been here and we're learning English and we're building a new life here. And we miss our home and our family, but we're building a new life. And, you know, tended to focus on the positive so much.
Mm-hmm.
The overall part of the project was, after documenting these stories, the project We Create was designed to capture the refugee stories through interviews and have those stories be watched by artists who would then create art based on the stories that they saw.
Wow.
So after the stories were edited down to less than 10-minute stories, probably about 20 to 25 different artists watched those stories and either in collaboration or individually made art that ranged from painting to sketching to sculpture to dance to creating music to creating soundscape to photography to capture these immigrant stories. And sometimes in just a portrait of the person and sometimes in something that was more of an artistic expression of the entire journey. Mm-hmm. And so that project was on display at pop-up events around Jefferson County in June of this year. Uh-huh. And so I think the culmination was at the Brown Theater on a Saturday night where there was about 2 hours of performances with a bunch of visual art in the lobby. Right. And it was attended by several hundred people. And we're working on a documentary, that project right now, that captures not just the refugee experience, but captures the artist's experience and why they decided to create this particular piece of art based on that part of the story.
Right. And are the artists also refugees?
Largely, no. The artists, by and large, were Americans who were very supportive of the immigrant experience, but were not immigrants themselves. Mm-hmm. There were, however, a couple of them who had been in the country for a longer period of time, 5 to 10 years, and because of their own journey, they felt very sympathetic towards helping someone else tell their story. Right. There were definitely artists who were in that category as well.
Right. And so do you have a sense of when that'll premiere or the documentary?
I think that'll be out by the end of the year. There's just a couple more interviews to do and sort of stringing together the stories. That story is the story of the project. The individual stories of how one particular person came from Syria to here and their journey is a different and individual personal story. The documentary that we're putting together is sort of short form, maybe 10 to 12 minutes, is about the project. And so it definitely involves various immigrant stories, and it also involves artist stories on how they interpreted and created art based on those stories.
Right. Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
It's Ethics Forward on WFMP 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. We'll be back with Patrick Fitzgerald in just a moment, but first here's some great music from the compilation 33 RPM Voices of the Revolution, available for free download on Bandcamp.com. It's Emmanuel Jal from Sudan with We Want Peace.
Oh yeah! Oh yeah! I'm looking for some people who's looking for peace. Maybe together we could make the war cease. Now we can send mankind to the moon. And we can reach to the bottom of the sea. That's why it really kind of baffles me that we cannot end wars and bring peace. And we cannot change the way people act. And we cannot change the way people think. So if we sit back, chill out and relax, civilization will soon be extinct. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world. Come on, people, would you help me? Let's scream and shout, cause we want peace. To say the least, I dedicate this song to the common people caught in the middle of this common evil. I wish the world was a little bit fairer. Time to start looking at the man in the mirror. Fear is the devil's policeman. Fear make good genocide with Hitler so he can. Feel a warm genocide and havoc was weakened. Tighten up the land cause nobody was speaking. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world. Come on people, would you help me? Let's scream and shout, cause we want peace. To say the least, somebody said after Rwanda. And after Rwanda, and not far from Rwanda. Who's gonna shout for the poor people living in Darfur? The world gone deaf, the world gone blind. The world busy sitting down on the behind. Nobody care about the poor and needy. Too busy sucking up to the rich and the greedy. For every hero there's a villain. I am killing, we gotta shout, sending out our city. One more time, we got no more time. We gotta figure out the way that we could all combine. Like Jericho, the world comes stumbling down. The sound of voices out of cities surround. You know what it's worth? Time to put our voices to work. We gotta shake down heaven and earth. That's why I am. I'm calling on the whole wide world.
come back to HYR for a minute. How do people get involved in HYR, or how do they keep up with what's happening in the league?
We run four seasons. We run a spring and fall soccer. We run a summer baseball. And then we just started up a winter league. This will be our first one in a very long time. That is going to be a combination of basketball and futsal. Futsal is like indoor gym soccer. So there's a website, www.hyrsports.com. Mm-hmm. There are registration links on that page and also information about the seasons and a calendar that shows when registrations are due for different sports.
Right. And is it a neighborhood only? I mean, I know it's named for the Highlands, but can people from anywhere in Louisville do this? Or are there leagues that are with a similar ethos elsewhere in the city?
I think that transportation is the only obstacle to HYR being somewhat local. It's named Highlands Youth Recreation because we're in the Highlands and we're associated with Highlands Community Ministries.
Right.
We send out flyers to schools beyond the Highlands.
Uh-huh.
But if you look at 40204 and 40205 as the epicenter of the majority of the people who play in the league, the school flyers go out an extra zip code in each direction uh-huh. to try and attract students. People come from as far away as J-Town or from Portland, but the majority, I would say 80%, probably come from those two zip codes mm-hmm. just because of proximity.
Sure.
And also the advertising we do with signs, that's
oh,
just
right,
it's word of mouth, you know, peer groups. And so it tends to be people who live close and know other people who are playing.
Right. And I was going to ask if you know of other leagues that have a similar ethos or if it's pretty unique in town.
I think that we are probably in the minority in that we are accepting of all applications and that we have volunteer coaches. And what some of this developmental or educational experience as opposed to uber competitive, and not 100% unique in that way. And I mentioned the YMCA does similar things. But there are many that are based on geography.
Right.
There's leagues that are Linden, Hikes Point, Shively, and so on. And
right.
so most of the kids come from there. So I don't think that the geography is particularly unique either.
Right.
As we try and build teams that have some version of team balance,
uh-huh.
as we strive towards getting there, the stories I hear from people whose kids play on select leagues involve some sort of draft and rating of players, but that there are, just like any system where someone can benefit, if you put too much incentive in winning or put too much incentive on the competitive nature of it, there's always someone who will try and game the system.
Right.
So I've heard stories of a coach who's involved in the rating process who wants to select a player, and so they will rate them particularly low so that they get then to pick them up on the draft.
Right.
And that's, in other words, every time you try and institute a part of fairness, there's somebody who's going to game that and try and get an
right.
unfair advantage to, you know, game that system in some way.
Right. Wow. You've heard of that happening in HYR, or you've heard of that happening?
No. I heard that happening in a select league.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
You may remember Rick Pitino did that when he went straight from UK to the Boston Celtics,
uh-huh.
and he had two players he wanted to draft. He was down talking. One was Antoine Walker, and the other player was the player who got hurt, and he was talking about he's an uncoachable player, he's not very good, and then because he down talked him, other people didn't draft him, and then he drafted him.
Jeez. Good riddance. Well, Patrick Fitzgerald, director of Highlands Youth Recreation, and the director of the film We Create, which will be out by the end of this year. Thank you so much for being on Ethics Forward.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me.
And that was my interview with Patrick Fitzgerald, director of Highlands Youth Recreation, on the value of youth sports and its role in building community. Ethics Forward comes to you every week as I sit down with a scholar, an activist, or a practitioner to talk about ethical issues in our daily lives and social institutions. Ethics Forward is made possible by the volunteer labor of all the good folks at WFMP 106.5 FM Forward Radio in lovely downtown Louisville, Kentucky. Forward Radio thrives on the volunteer labor and voluntary donations of folks just like you. If you're thinking about end-of-year charitable donations and you value what you hear on this show and other amazing shows, including both local content and our feed from Pacifica Radio and Radio Free Nashville, please consider including Forward Radio in your giving plans. You can do that by surfing over to forwardradio.org and clicking on the Donate button. While you're over there at forwardradio.org, click on forwardradio.org/ethicsforward and see the entire Ethics Forward archive dating back some 60 shows, which you can listen to and share with friends and family far and wide. Ethics Forward also benefits from the editing, production, and strategic support of Maddie Claybo, whose work is made possible by the University of Louisville Philosophy Department. And I'm grateful for the music and production help of Prismic, who's also on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/prismicofficial. Now to take you out, here's one of my favorite songs by Prismic.